Today's episode is sponsored by City of Ghosts, a brand new supernatural neo-noir mystery podcast set in New York City. I'm about to play you a preview of City of Ghosts. The first and second episode are being released on the 5th of October, so go to your favourite podcast app right now and subscribe. I think that Morbidology listeners are going to love it.
It's 1999, New York City.
Where am I?
Who are you?
Oh, shut up!
Bridget Lundy Payne stars in a new supernatural neo-noir audio drama.
The voices, they're back.
City of Ghosts.
I understand this is beyond your usual scope.
So two deaths and an attempted third.
Must mean we're onto something big.
Men like them have fortresses built around them.
What good does sticking your neck out do, especially in this city?
Still, just be careful.
Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
Do be well, Eleanor.
Like most of you, I'm hoping that things will get back to normal soon, and we can hang out with our friends, go to the bar, and even travel. If you're wanting to keep yourself preoccupied while we wait for some normalcy, download Best Fiends. It's been keeping me preoccupied during the past while, and it's a great game filled with cute characters, which is a refreshing break from true crime writing. They've even sponsored today's episode of Morbidology. With Best Fiends, the fun never ends. There's thousands of levels and tons of characters. I'm on level 291, but there's new puzzles to solve each and every day. It's one of those games where 30 minutes really feels like 30 seconds. Best Fiends is super easy to follow and it's fun to play. It's a casual game that won't stress you out, and it's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it before bed, and when I need a break while writing. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. Temple Terrace is a city located in northeastern Hillsborough County, Florida. The most frequent crime in the primarily suburban area is burglary and theft. Murders in Temple Terrace are extremely rare, and between 2000 and 2014, only 10 murders took place in the city. In 2014, the local police department would investigate an extremely horrific and confusing murder case, quite unlike anything the city had ever seen before. Felicia Williams was a 9-year-old girl from Tampa, Florida. She attended Edison Elementary School, where she made friends with ease because of her friendly and kind demeanor. She was a very active child, who loved riding her bicycle to the nearby baseball fields and feeding the ducks. Felicia really enjoyed being outside and took pleasure in playing hide-and-seek and tag, along with her friends. Zakiya, one of her best friends, said that she was always quick with a knock-knock joke. Her sister, Shaquilla, said, "Everybody loved her. She's a sweetheart." Felicia could always make people laugh and was a member of the Jackson Heights Viking Cheer Squad. She and her family were active members in the church, where Felicia sang in the youth choir. You can see a photograph of Felicia on the Vodacast app. On the 16th of May 2014, Felicia disappeared under very strange circumstances. She was last seen at some point between 5:30 p.m. and 6 p.m. at the Doral Oaks apartment complex in the 8900 block of Tanglewood Place in Temple Terrace. The apartment complex was not far from the intersection of 56th Street and Bush Boulevard. Felicia lived in Tampa with her family, but on this day, a family friend had picked her up from her home at around 4 p.m. and brought her to Temple Terrace. According to Felicia's mother, she was at the hairdresser's when Felicia called her and asked for permission to go with the female family friend. Her mother, Felicia Demerson, said that the woman, whose last name she did not know, was a former neighbour and a friend of around a year. Felicia had gone out with the woman several times in the past. That afternoon, Felicia and the woman went to a fast food restaurant and then to the Doral Oaks apartment complex. According to Demerson, however, she wasn't sure why they went to the apartment complex in Doral Oaks. According to the friend, she had left Felicia in front of the TV watching a cartoon movie while she went for a shower. She said that when she left the bathroom, Felicia had vanished from the apartment. Before 5 a.m. the following morning, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement issued a missing child alert. Missing person flyers were distributed throughout the area, which described Felicia as a black female, standing at around 4 feet 5 inches tall and weighing around 100 pounds. She had black hair and brown eyes. When she vanished, she was wearing a black and green striped t-shirt, blue jeans and black shoes. The Temple Terrace Police Department were assisted by deputies with the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, as well as officers with the Tampa Police Department and personnel with the Temple Terrace Fire Department. Investigators would announce that there wasn't any evidence of foul play. A search party was assembled and they scoured the area surrounding the Doral Oaks apartment complex. Sniffer dogs were called in to assist and they searched throughout the woodland, ponds and the Hillsborough River, which was located nearby. Felicia's mother, Demerson, said, "I'm sitting here hoping there will be good news. I know my baby. She would call her mama if she could." Felicia's family said that there would be no reason just for her to get up and leave. Her 24-year-old sister, Shaquilla Givens, stated, "Felicia would never leave. She would never, ever wander off." According to investigators working on the disappearance, they were treating the case as an isolated incident. They made contact with all local sex offenders, but none of them could provide any assistance, and none were considered suspects in the disappearance or persons of interest. That afternoon, however, there was a grim update in the case when it was announced that the body of a young girl had been found nestled among the rocks and mangroves on the Pinellas County side of Tampa Bay. A couple had been fishing from the Courtney Campbell Causeway at around 3:20 p.m. when they spotted a body floating in the water and called Clearwater Police, who came and retrieved the body. While the body was not yet positively identified, investigators stated that they believed the body was Felicia. Spokesman Michael Dunn stated, "We don't know what occurred here yet. This is still under investigation." You can learn more about the discovery of the body on the Vodacast app. The circumstances surrounding Felicia's disappearance were certainly confusing, to say the very least. The family friend had not yet been identified in the media, nor was it revealed whose apartment Felicia had been at when she disappeared. Investigators stated that the woman was cooperating with the investigation. They also revealed that the family friend, who by this point was still unidentified by the media, had searched for Felicia for around 5 hours before reporting her missing to her mother and the police. It was revealed that there was another adult who was still unidentified in the media who was at the apartment at the time that Felicia vanished. However, this person claimed that they were in their bedroom and had never seen Felicia. The following day, the woman who had been looking after Felicia when she vanished was arrested. She would be identified as 23-year-old Ebony Wiley, and she was facing one count of providing false information to law enforcement during the course of an investigation. She would be released quite quickly after posting a bond of $2,000. Meanwhile, the body that was found was positively identified as Felicia, and the medical examiner revealed that her manner of death was homicide, but he would not disclose the cause of death just yet. Following the heartbreaking update, Temple Terrace Police Chief Ken Albano said that he had met with Demerson and shared hugs and prayers, and swore that he would bring her daughter's killer to justice.
It was very emotional, very emotional. I was there hugging the mom, and we were in there with the family praying, quite frankly.
He stated in the media, "My primary goal is to ensure that I present to our state attorney's office a fantastic case for them to prosecute, so that this person stands accountable for this atrocity." He said that he would not yet be releasing any information about potential suspects or persons of interest, but said that they were following several leads, adding that no immediate family members were considered suspects in the murder. Chief Albano would further reveal that when Ebony had contacted police and told them about the disappearance, she had not been truthful. He wouldn't expand any further, but said that the information she provided was conflicting and led them to speculate that Felicia had simply ran away, and that prevented them from issuing an Amber Alert. He said that as more information came out, it soon became apparent how urgent the situation was. He said that he was not going to release any more information at the time to protect the integrity of the investigation and to prevent tipping off the suspect. Crime Stoppers Tampa Bay would put forward a $3,000 reward for whoever could provide information about what happened to Felicia. Her mother, Demerson, made a public appeal for information, stating, "Not only do I need closure for my baby, I need closure for my soul, because it's aching and I just want answers." She said that she believed that the answers as to what happened to her daughter lay with Ebony. With the body being positively identified as Felicia, grief counsellors were dispatched to Edison Elementary School to help her classmates work through their grief. The children were all given the chance to ask any questions, and they were encouraged to draw pictures and make cards for Felicia's family. Psychologist Katie Wiles also spent around an hour in Felicia's class with her classmates. She said that there were some children who were more impacted than others, and some who needed that extra little bit of care. Meanwhile, the media would be scrambling to try and find more information about Ebony and the facts surrounding Felicia's disappearance and subsequent murder. They would uncover that Ebony had a history of mental illness. 2 years earlier, she had undergone a mental health evaluation after telling people that Satan was trapping her mind. In January of 2012, police were called to a gas station in Tampa, where Ebony was seemingly hallucinating. Ebony's mother, Sabrina Teal, would come to her daughter's defense and share some more information. She said that Ebony had met Felicia and her family when they moved into the same neighborhood that she was living in. She stated, "I know that my daughter would not hurt anybody or anybody's child. This particular one really loved my daughter. She clung to us." She revealed some more information about Ebony, revealing that she worked as a housekeeper at Whispering Oaks Nursing Home. The murder of Felicia and the lack of suspects in the case, at least being named publicly, left residents in the area feeling more than uneasy. There was a fear quivering in the air that a child killer was free and roaming the streets. Tisha Sumter, who lived at the Doral Oaks apartment, said that she was thinking about putting a chain lock on her front door. She said to the Tampa Tribune, "It makes me feel a bit better if there's a little extra on my door. I was asking questions. I don't want to take chances when it comes to my kids or their safety." Alexia Diaz, who also lived in the apartment complex, said that the complex had been eerily quiet since Felicia's body was found. She said, "That's scary that they can take a kid in broad daylight." A relative of Felicia, Tyrone House, would divulge to the media that he had spoken with Ebony the day after Felicia was reported missing, and she had relayed to him a confusing story. She had told him that she was upset with Felicia for bothering her while she was at work at the nursing home. He stated, "She told me that's why she came to pick her up. She brought her some checkers and then took her to a friend's place in Temple Terrace." The community wouldn't be waiting long before a suspect was finally identified. On the Wednesday, 35-year-old Granville Ritchie was named as a suspect in the murder. He had been arrested earlier that day on an unrelated drug charge. While investigators announced his arrest, they didn't elaborate any further that day. During a press conference, Police Chief Albano stated, If you have information, if you've been scared to share it with us, now is the time. I cannot emphasize it enough. Help us bring the murderer of this little girl to justice. Following Granville's arrest, it was announced that he was facing 4 further counts of unlawful sex with a minor. This involved another victim, not Felicia. A police spokesperson would reveal that this victim was being interviewed as a potential witness in relation to Felicia's murder when she disclosed the sexual abuse. This wasn't the first time that Granville had been in trouble with law enforcement. He had an arrest history dating back to 2007. On the 24th of May 2013, he was charged with sexual battery, aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, and domestic battery by strangulation. However, the woman who had made the complaint would refuse to cooperate with prosecutors, and the charges would ultimately be dropped. A couple of weeks after that incident, Granville's wife, Todra Ritchie, filed an injunction for protection order against domestic violence against Granville. The couple had been married since 2006. In February, he had also been charged with possession of a controlled substance, ecstasy. While investigators were remaining very tight-lipped on the case and the evidence they had gathered, which made them zone in on Granville as a suspect, a family friend would reveal that Granville and his mother, Gloria Gibson, had been living at the Doral Oaks apartment where Felicia had vanished from. Antoinette Donaldson had known Granville since he was a little boy. They had both lived in Jamaica and grew up in Kingston, and both moved to Florida within years of each other. In March of 2008, Antoinette had actually called police after she saw Granville and his brother, Trevor, get into an argument which resulted in Trevor grabbing a butcher knife and swinging it at Granville. When Antoinette learned that Granville was a suspect in the murder of Felicia, she said that she was surprised. She stated, "That's not the type of person I knew him as. I don't know him as a person who could do that." On the 23rd of May, Mount Zion Church was filled to the brim with friends and family of Felicia, who gathered for her wake. There was an altar at the front of the church with a photograph of Felicia in a purple dress, which she wore as a flower girl in a wedding a few months prior. Beside the altar, there were pink and white flowers. The investigators who were working on the homicide case also attended the wake. As Police Chief Albano left, he stated, "It's such a horrible, horrible act for anyone to perpetrate on anyone else. But when you're talking about a 9-year-old little girl, it just magnifies everything." The following day, Felicia's funeral was held at the Rock Church of God by Faith on East Henry Avenue. While it was a funeral, Felicia's loved ones were gathering to celebrate her life, as opposed to dwelling on her death. Her family said that they did not want to mark Felicia's death with talk of the evil that had taken her from her family. Her flower-adorned casket arrived on a white funeral carriage drawn by a single horse. Friends, family, and even complete strangers followed the casket into the church, while some in attendance recited Psalm 23. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake." The funeral was led by Pastor Nathaniel House, who stated, "I can understand the pain of the family. He can heal you in a time of trouble." He said that Felicia was in the hands of the Lord, and her afterlife was just beginning. Felicia was remembered as having an easy smile, a mischievous laugh, and the ability of making herself unforgettable. A family friend would joke that the angels were going to have trouble on their hands with Felicia, while Pastor House jokingly said that she would have been whispering at him to hurry the service along so that she could go and eat lunch. At the end of the service, her casket was wheeled into the carriage, which then drove her to Shady Grove Cemetery, where she would be buried. Her casket had been engraved with the words "Sugar Plum," which is what Felicia was called by her family. If you're like me, then you never tire of a classic whodunit. Well, I have the perfect game for you, June's Journey. This is a free-to-download mobile game, and the objective is to find objects that are hidden within beautiful, colourful, and carefully crafted scenes. June's Journey is set in the 1920s and has a really glamorous aesthetic, as well as a diverse cast of characters. You get to play as June Parker, an amateur detective investigating a series of mysteries. Each scene in the game takes you through a murder mystery, but along the way, you'll find yourself uncovering a number of secrets, with lots of twists and turns around every corner. What I love especially about this game is that it's super relaxing and therapeutic, but at the same time, it really tests your observations and keeps your mind fresh. I even find myself playing this game as I'm cooking dinner. Ready to awaken your inner detective? Download Dune's Journey for free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Before the month came to a close, a search warrant affidavit would be filed, and while it was anticipated that this would clear some information up, especially in regards to Felicia's actual disappearance, it just made things all that more conflicting. It provided two separate timelines. One was a revised story from Ebony. While first she had claimed that Felicia vanished while she was in the shower, she now claimed that she had actually vanished when she left the apartment to purchase drugs. The second story was from Granville, who claimed that Felicia vanished while he and Ebony were having sex in the bedroom. This was the first piece of information which placed Granville at the apartment when Felicia vanished. According to Ebony's revised version of events, she had left Felicia alone with Granville in the apartment for around 35 minutes as she went to buy marijuana. She said that while she was out, she had received a panicked phone call from Granville, who claimed that he had given Felicia a couple of dollars to go and buy some candy at a nearby CVS, but she had not returned. Ebony said that she rushed back to the apartment, which was now identified as Granville's apartment, where she and Granville drank Hennessy, prayed, and then had sex. They didn't think to report Felicia missing. A couple of hours later, Granville drove Ebony back home, and she finally told Felicia's family that she was missing. She also revealed that she had a three-way conversation with Granville and his mother, Gloria, to develop the original story about Felicia vanishing while she was in the shower. However, when investigators interviewed Granville, he told a completely different story. He said that Felicia had disappeared while he and Ebony were having sex for 45 minutes. He said that Ebony had briefly searched for Felicia before he drove her home and then went to visit a friend.
Went over there, we were there chilling. Of course, me and the girl is gonna get private, you know what I mean? Because, right? So,
your mom's house, where is that at?
It's right over by Dora Oaks.
Oh, Dora Oaks, okay.
Dora, yeah, all
right.
So, I'm in the room, getting it on. Of course, I was, I'll be honest. Mm-hmm. That's what I was doing. You know, no, before we go in the room, I put a movie in. He said, you want to watch cartoon? You know, let me watch a movie. I had a cartoon movie, I put it in. I can't remember the name of the cartoon. I want to remember it because it was, I was saying, this cartoon, they cussing it. And she was like, I don't care. And I'm like, I really don't want to listen to that. You know, but she's like, she shut me. She didn't, and I'm like, okay. Put that in, and I went to the room. When we came out of that room, man, that little girl was gone. That little girl wasn't in the house.
He said that the friend wasn't in, so he went back to Doral Oaks and just hung out for a couple of hours before Ebony showed up with her brother to get the apartment number for police. He said that he then left the apartment around midnight and drove to stay the night with his girlfriend, Calissa Keeley, in St. Petersburg. He also revealed during his interview that he had been with Ebony when she picked Felicia up. You can watch the entire interrogation on the Vodacast app. While Granville had been arrested and named as a suspect, he had not yet been charged with the murder of Felicia. Investigators would set up message boards along the Courtney Campbell Causeway, asking for information regarding the murder. They also held a press conference asking the public for any information relating to any suspicious activity that they may have seen in the area of the Courtney Campbell Causeway, which was where Felicia's body had been found. A $13,000 reward was offered by Crime Stoppers of Tampa and the FBI. With Granville behind bars, his wife, Todra, filed for divorce. She spoke with the Tampa Tribune and said that she and Granville had been estranged for over a year. She said that she and her two daughters were trying to move on with their lives and stated that her heart went out to Felicia's family. In mid-June, Granville appeared in court where the judge revoked his bond on the drug charge. He was ordered to remain in jail, at least for now, He had still not been charged with Felicia's murder, and prosecutors on the case were going to great lengths to try and keep him behind bars. Typically, since he was only facing a minor drug charge, he would have been released on bail. The prosecutors had fought to keep him in jail. They presented evidence that Granville had committed other crimes while out on bond from a drug charge back in February. Among those crimes was the accusation that he had been sexually abusing an underage girl on several occasions. The girl in question was 17 years old. Shortly thereafter, Granville's defence lawyer, Thomas Maiello, wrote in a court motion that some of the charges were questionable because they stemmed from an improper police search of his cell phone. He wrote, "To the best of counsel's knowledge, no search warrant was obtained prior to law enforcement's search of private information found on the defendant's cell phone." He revealed that Granville's cell phone had placed him and Felicia at the Temple Terrace apartment. It was also information on his cell phone which led them to the underage girl he had been sexually abusing. Just a couple of days later, a number of charges against Granville would be dropped, and investigators announced that they were only going to be pursuing one of the four sex charges against him. There was a massive fear within the community that Granville would be released on bail, since a number of the charges were dropped. However, Judge Chet Tharp announced that he would remain behind bars without bail. 3 months would pass since Felicia's murder, and her family would state that they had confidence in the investigators working on the case and anticipated that charges would be filed against Granville. Terrace Temple Police Department rarely investigated homicides. In fact, they had only had 10 other murders since 2000, and 3 of those remained unsolved. While they didn't have the same resources as larger police departments, Police Chief Albano said that did not affect their ability to investigate homicides. Felicia's mother, Demerson, would state that she had been having dreams of her daughter and was clinging to the hope that justice would one day be served. She said in those dreams, Felicia would come to her, take her by the hand, and together they would walk through the apartment complex in Temple Terrace where she had vanished from. They always stopped at the front door and Felicia turned to her mother and stated, "I'm only going to wake you up because I don't think you can handle the rest." Demerson said that the dreams were so frequent that she didn't like to go to sleep anymore. While she knew that her daughter was dead, she didn't know her cause of death or what her last moments on earth were like. Speaking of Ebony, she said she felt as though she had been betrayed, and Felicia had certainly been betrayed. Felicia had loved Ebony, and as Demerson said, "My daughter really adored, cherished, worshipped the ground Ebony walked on." In early August, Ebony pleaded not guilty to providing false information to investigators. Just the following day, the update that everybody was anticipating finally came when Granville was charged with the first-degree murder of Felicia. As the announcement was read aloud during a press conference, Felicia's family cried in both pain but also relief, because they knew that this was a step forward in the direction of justice. More information would be revealed regarding the murder of Felicia, and the details were extremely grisly. She had been beaten, raped, strangled, and then stuffed into a suitcase and dumped in the bay.
At this moment, detectives from the Temple Terrace Police Department are in the process of formally charging Granville Ritchie with the murder of 9-year-old Felicia Williams. Our investigation indicates that Felicia suffered antemortem blunt force trauma through her head, that she was sexually assaulted, and that she was ultimately strangled to death. Evidence at the scene indicated that Felicia's body had been concealed within a suitcase and dragged from the apartment. Cell site data analysis also revealed that Ritchie traveled to the area where Felicia's body was recovered and that he remained there for a prolonged period of time.
After the announcement of the charge, Police Chief Albano spoke with Channel 8 News and said that he carried Felicia's missing person poster in his pocket each day to remind him to fight for justice for her and her family. He said, "We know we can't bring her back, but we can bring justice to her family." Granville would appear in court to be formally charged with Felicia's murder. During the court hearing, more details were revealed. According to Ebony, when she returned to the apartment to find that Felicia was gone, Granville was shirtless and sweaty, Granville had claimed that he drove to Thanodosasa to visit a friend after dropping Ebony back home before going to visit his girlfriend in St. Petersburg. However, his cell phone records indicated that he had returned to his apartment in Temple Terrace, and later went to the site where Felicia's body was found in Clearwater. Investigators had obtained search warrants for the apartment and the Lexus Ritchie car that Granville had been driving at the time, and found several pieces of evidence. Furthermore, the apartment appeared to be cleaned very recently, and investigators found wheel tracks on the carpet leading to the patio. On the patio, they found a broken wheel and a zipper from a protege suitcase. According to witnesses, Granville owned two such suitcases. When his car was searched, however, one of these suitcases was found. Inside his car, investigators also found soil and plant material, which matched samples from the site where Felicia's body was found. Unsurprisingly, given the brutality of the murder, prosecutors announced that they would be seeking the death penalty against Granville if he were found guilty. When Demerson was asked what she thought of the decision, she simply replied, "God is good." The trial would be scheduled for July of 2019. In May of that year, defense attorneys requested the trial to be pushed back to give them more time to prepare. Judge Michelle Sisko, however, refused to push the trial back, stating, "It is happening. It is time for finality. We're going to trial." There had already been quite a long delay because of the legal uncertainty surrounding the death penalty in Florida. In 2016, the US Supreme Court had declared it constitutional, and a year of legal wrangling would follow before death penalty prosecutors could continue again, but with new requirements that juries must unanimously recommend a death sentence. I've mentioned this a handful of times in earlier episodes of Morbidology. In June, however, the trial was pushed back until September. The defense stated that they had still needed to interview some members of Granville's family, and these family members lived in Jamaica. On the 12th of September 2019, the murder trial finally began. During the opening statements, Assistant State Attorney Scott Harmon said, "Felicia Williams' life meant nothing to this man. The evidence will be clear. Man-sized hands choked the life out of her."
This is Felicia. Her family called her Sugar Plum. She was in third grade. She was 9 years old. In the spring of 2014, she left her home on Ida Street in Tampa, where she lived with her mother and her sisters. She left her home with a young woman who had befriended the family, had moved in not too long before this and had befriended the family and had become close to Felicia and her family. A young lady who took it upon herself to refer to herself as Felicia's godmother. Felicia left home that day with this woman, but they didn't leave there alone. They left there with a man in this car. That man drove them from the city of Tampa up into Temple Terrace to an apartment complex in Temple Terrace. And when they had been inside of that apartment for about 45 minutes to 50 minutes, the young woman, the godmother, left. She left Felicia there, alone with this man. Completely in his care, completely in his custody, and totally at his mercy. The evidence will show that man didn't hesitate. He didn't wait around. The evidence will show that the man who brought Felicia to that apartment attacked this little girl. The evidence will show that he put his hands around her throat and he strangled her. He strangled her until he had choked the life out of this little girl.
As he spoke to the jury, a photograph of Felicia smiling was presented on a TV monitor above the witness stand. He took the jury through some facts of the case, stating that it all began with a woman named Ebony. He said that she was a family friend, a cousin to one of Felicia's older sisters. He said that Felicia's mother had trusted Ebony because she appeared to really and truly care for Felicia. He said that the two of them rode bicycles together, attended church together, and visited the park. They were so close, in fact, that Ebony referred to herself as Felicia's godmother. He stated that Ebony and Granville had met in spring of 2014, and that she had been charmed by his Jamaican accent. She had saved his phone number in her phone as my husband. Attorney Harmon would tell the jury that a few days before Felicia had vanished, she had shown up at Ebony's place of employment and gotten her into trouble. Ebony was upset and said that she had wanted to counsel Felicia, not only in regards to this, but allegedly in regards to an incident wherein Felicia had been caught stealing. When Ebony mentioned it to Granville, he thought that it was a great idea. On that fateful afternoon, Felicia was taken to Granville's apartment. Here, Ebony took an ecstasy pill before she and Granville spoke to Felicia about stealing. Granville had staged a demonstration, placing money on the sofa. He asked Felicia if he left and came back, would the money still be there? To which she replied, maybe. Ebony would leave the apartment to go and purchase some marijuana. She had wanted Felicia to come with her, but Granville stated he would look after her at the apartment. When Ebony returned to the apartment, Felicia was gone and Granville was said to be distraught. He claimed that he had given Felicia some money to go and buy some candy at a CVS store. Ebony went to the store to try and find Felicia, but to no avail. When she returned to the apartment, she found Granville shirtless, sweaty, and panicked. They spoke about what to do. Instead of calling police, they drank whiskey, had sex, and Ebony prayed. Later that night, Ebony finally told Felicia's family that she was missing. Attorney Harmon revealed that Granville's cell phone had created a digital trail. It showed him making calls and text messages from the Temple Terrace apartment throughout the day. Late that night, the signal changed to another tower and kept switching to others as the phone moved west into Tampa and then across the Courtney Campbell Causeway, where Felicia's body would be found. At around midnight, there was a 27-minute gap when Granville made no calls or texts, and in that time, his phone was located at the west side of the causeway. The defense team refused to present an opening statement, and the first witness was called to testify. Felicia's mother, Felicia Demerson, described her daughter as mischievous, amazing, and said that she was a beautiful little girl. She told the courtroom that Felicia was known as Sugar Plum to her family. She went on to describe how her daughter was close to their neighbor, Ebony, and said that Ebony had introduced Felicia to Granville. Ebony would be called as a witness. She described how she had met Granville shortly before Felicia had vanished. He had pulled up alongside her as she was walking along a street in East Tampa and asked her how old she was. He then took her phone number and they met up later that night, and he had charmed her with talk of a wealthy future. While on the witness stand, Ebony stated, "He sold me a dream." However, within just days, that dream transformed into a nightmare. She became emotional on the witness stand as she recollected how she left Felicia alone with Granville as she went to purchase some marijuana. She revealed that it was Granville who told her to leave the apartment and purchase some marijuana. She said, "I wasn't concerned because of how he made me feel on that first night. He had that concern like a father figure. That's how I felt." She told the courtroom that she was gone for around 50 minutes and had paid $20 for a bag of marijuana. When she returned to the apartment, she found Granville sweaty, shirtless, and he appeared to be extremely panicked.
What did he look like?
He had no shirt on. He was.
He
had no shirt on. He looked like he was sweating, like he was just. And I looked up as I was driving. I looked up. I'm like, damn, what is going on? So I pulled in the drive-thru, the park lot, and I went upstairs, and he was telling me, dang, I let her go to the store and she ain't come back yet.
Let me stop you for a minute. When you left to go buy the marijuana, was the defendant fully clothed?
Yes, he was.
After she realized that Felicia was missing, prosecutor Jennifer Johnson asked, "Did you look around for Felicia?" And Ebony replied, "No, I did not." She was asked if she trusted what Granville was saying, that Felicia was not there, to which he responded, "Yes, I trusted him." It wouldn't be until Felicia's body was found that Ebony finally told the truth about what had happened at the apartment. She said to the jury, "I told a lot of stories. Yes, I lied. I can admit that. Yes, I lied. Yes, I was on drugs."
Why is it that you decided to change your story and then tell them that there was a man back there?
Because, I don't know. I just tell them the truth. And then at, by the end of the night when they told me that she's dead, I was like, no, I really left her with this man. So if it's end up to being something, somebody need to say something.
But when you told them that it was there a man, that a man was there, and mm-hmm. you were in the shower and she walked away, that was not the truth, though, correct?
No, that was not the truth.
Did you stick with that story, or did you?
When they told me that she was dead, I told the truth.
When did you learn that Felicia was located?
Before they arrested me.
Let me finish my question, Ms. Wiley, before you answer, okay? When you learned that Felicia had been found dead, mm-hmm. where were you?
In the police station.
The same night of May 17th of 2014?
Right, that's there, yes.
And how is it that you learned that?
By the end of the night, they had put me in another room, and they sat me down, and it was like, now, you need to tell the truth. Where do you think she at? And I'm like, she probably somewhere in somebody's house. And
did
like,
you honestly think that, or were
yes,
you?
Yes, I honestly thought that.
How did you think she would be in somebody's house?
Because Sugar Plum is one friendly person. She was just freely to talk to anybody. She wasn't scared.
So you were told that she was found deceased. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so what did you tell law enforcement then?
I told them that I lied, and they was like, "What you lied about?" I said I left her with Trevor, and he wanted me to go and get some weed for him. And then when I came back, she wasn't there.
The interrogation between Granville and investigators would be played out during the trial. He would be interviewed on the 17th of May. Detective Thomas Carroll asked him if he knew where Felicia may be, to which he replied, "I wish I knew." He accounted for the past 24 hours of his life and stated, "This situation is very complicated for me. Very, very." He said how he had met Ebony just a couple of days beforehand, and she had expressed concern for Felicia and feared that she was stealing.
Mm-hmm. The reason we asked you to come down here and we talked to Ebony is over the missing child. Mm-hmm. So we just wanted to get your story about mm-hmm. everything from yesterday, mm-hmm. or let's even go back to when you met Ebony, right straight through yesterday mm-hmm. and through mm-hmm. today.
Okay.
So how long have you known Ebony?
I know Ebony, I would say, we're not to a week, no.
A little over a week?
Mm-hmm. What would you say?
And where did you meet her?
I meet her over by 15th and... Hillsborough.
Can you tell me how you met her?
Yes, I was driving and I saw her and I pulled over. I said, "Can I talk to you?" You know what I mean? And she was with another little girl and she's like, "Oh, this is such and such, my daughter, not by my goddaughter, sister." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, that's fine." And I met them and, you know, then that was that. And then I talked to her on the phone later on, and then we hooked up later on by ourselves, and then, you know, we chill, and, you know, then she went up.
Now, have I ever seen her again from that until yesterday? Okay, let's go with yesterday. Mm-hmm. Tell me.
Yesterday, she got off work, and she said, "Hey, I'm off work. You want to pick me up?" And, you know, so I'm like, "That's fine." Picked her up. She was telling me about the girl that I met, the other little girl, her little sister. She was like, "Her little sister, that's my goddaughter. You know, she's like, she's a troubled girl. She came at my job 3 times when I wasn't there, walking around, and the people that was threatening to call the cops, saying she should be in school." And this happened yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, like, yesterday and the day before, she was wandering around, and you know, so she called me, and she was telling me that.
So I'm like, maybe she's looking for you. You know, maybe she wants you to help her. And she's like, yeah, she loves me, but she's a little girl. She steals a lot. She don't listen. I don't want no problems. I'm the one who tell her, look, man, she's reaching out to you. You know, so if you could help her, help her. I convinced that girl to do that.
He claimed they put a DVD on for Felicia while they had sex in the bedroom. And when they came out, Felicia was gone. He stated, I said to Ebony to drive around and look in the complex while I'm on the porch, looking to see if she comes back. He claimed that he visited a friend in Thanota Sasa and then went to his girlfriend's apartment in St. Petersburg. That girlfriend, Calissa Kelly, would be called to testify. She said that she had been in a relationship with Granville for 7 years, and she regularly visited him in jail while he was awaiting trial. She said that she believed that he was innocent of the murder of Felicia.
Well, in fact, before you came to talk to me, you went and visited with the defendant, correct? You had a visitation with him at the Hillsborough County Jail, correct?
Possibly, yeah, on a Sunday.
Right, uh-huh. And during that visitation, Mr. Ritchie told you, all you have to do is appear for trial. You didn't have to come talk to me, right?
I don't know if he said it in those words, but it was something pertaining to that.
Right. He told you, you don't have to talk to the prosecutor, correct?
I don't think it wasn't the said as talk to the prosecutor. He wasn't thinking it was the prosecutor.
Right. And Ms. Kelly, you are still in a relationship with this defendant, aren't you?
I am still his friend, yeah.
You know that what he's charged with, correct?
Correct.
Capital murder of a little girl and raping her. And for the last 5 years, you've remained his girlfriend, right? Isn't that correct?
Yes.
And in fact, you have visited him at the Hillsborough County Jail over 366 times.
Have I?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, isn't that true? I didn't know that. I don't know the numbers, but I've been there a lot.
And you have talked to him on the phone over 2,000 times over the last 5 years. Isn't that right?
Wow. I wasn't sure.
Isn't that correct?
I can't say that's correct. All I can say is I do speak to him on the phone. I don't know the many of times that I've spoken to him on the phone, but you are correct. We do still speak on the phone.
A video was shown from the 17th of May, which showed Calissa and Granville inside an Instalon store in St. Petersburg. Calissa testified that while in the store, Granville told her that he needed to take care of something and left her in the store and took her silver Lexus that she often let him borrow. Later, investigators asked to interview Calissa and search her car. Some forensic evidence would then be presented. The jury would hear about a tiny leaf which was lodged in the Lexus passenger side headlight. A forensic botanist would testify that the leaf had come from a mangrove tree and that only such plants grow near salt water. The area where Felicia's body had been found had mangrove trees growing alongside the road. According to investigators, it would be difficult to avoid hitting the mangrove branches while driving there. There was also sand found inside his car, which was a 99% match to the sand found where Felicia's body was found. Justin Fleck, an FBI agent, would testify next. He conducted a detailed analysis of Granville's cell phone. On the day that Felicia vanished, his cell phone was pinged to a tower north of his apartment in Temple Terrace. It continued to ping here until late, which contradicted his story that he had left to visit a friend in Thanota Sasa. At around 10 p.m, the phone began moving further west towards Tampa. The jury would be shown a series of maps which showed the phone continuing west. Then at around 11 p.m, the cell phone pinged to a tower south of Tampa International Airport, and minutes later it pinged to a tower near the east side of the causeway. It stayed here for around an hour. This was located near where Felicia's body was found. A pediatrician and pathologist would testify that there was evidence of sexual assault to Felicia's body. James Upshaw Downs, a forensic pathologist, spoke about the pain Felicia would have felt as she was being beaten, raped, and strangled. He said that there were injuries to her mouth which indicated that a hand may have been placed over it to prevent her from crying or screaming. However, Dr. William Anderson, who was called as a defense witness, would contradict this and say that in his opinion, the damage to Felicia's genital area was not consistent with sexual assault. He suggested that the damage to her genital area occurred when a medical examiner was taking DNA samples. The medical examiner who had taken the DNA samples would testify and completely refute this, stating that the damage was already present to Felicia's body when the samples were taken. Dr. Anderson, who was testifying for the defense, also offered a different cause of death. While other doctors and medical examiners testified that she had been manually strangled, he suggested that she had been asphyxiated as a result of pressure being applied to her upper chest. After all of the evidence was presented, it was time for closing arguments. The prosecutor told the jury, "There is a mountain of evidence." He played a portion of a 911 call which had come from Granville's phone, minutes after 5 p.m. on the day that Felicia was murdered. When the operator answered, there was only a low, indecipherable noise. He stated, "It's only a couple seconds long, but could you hear it? Could you hear the fear? It's the fear that comes from the heart and mind of a child." He theorized that the phone call had come from Felicia and was at the time when she was alone with Granville. The defense, on the other hand, argued that all of the evidence was circumstantial. They said that there was no DNA evidence, no hairs or fibers, and no sign of a struggle. He suggested it was reasonable for the jury to conclude that Ebony could have killed Felicia instead of Granville. The jury would deliberate for only 4 hours before returning with a verdict. They found Granville Ritchie guilty of the murder of Felicia Williams, as well as sexual battery and aggravated child abuse. The trial would then enter the penalty phase, and it would be up to the jury to decide whether to sentence Granville to death or life in prison. The prosecution would cite 3 aggravating factors to support their argument for the death penalty. They were that the victim was younger than 12, that her murder had occurred during a sexual battery, and that the murder was especially atrocious, heinous, and cruel. Granville's defense team would fight for his life and claim that medical scans had shown abnormalities in his brain. Hyman Einstein, a psychologist, testified for the defense and stated that Granville had an IQ of 78, which was well below average. He said that Granville had difficulty completing tasks. As the result of head trauma, he suffered during incidents.
You mentioned that he, the defendant, had been involved in some accidents. You had very few, if any, medical records to document these accidents, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So, again, you're relying on the self-reporting of the defendant?
Correct.
And so there was a slip when he was 10 years old and he hit the back of his head?
Correct.
You aren't aware of him requiring any stitches from that?
Correct.
No broken bones?
Correct.
No concussion?
Correct.
No loss of consciousness?
That's correct.
No hospital records to document that?
That's correct.
That's completely and solely his self-report?
That's correct.
You're not even aware of what kind of surface it was that he slipped and fell on?
That's correct.
Okay. Then there was another incident when he was a child, but there was no head injury in that incident, correct?
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
The desk incident?
Yeah, it's unclear.
Well, didn't you testify last night in your deposition that it wasn't, in fact, his head that got injured? It fell on his shoulder?
That's correct.
Okay, so it had nothing to do with his head?
Well, a huge desk coming from above, when it falls down, in all likelihood, between the shoulder and the head, it's going to be including in the head as well, part of it.
But you don't have the facts as to how this happened, correct?
A desk.
You're assuming.
Well, I was told.
Okay. You were told a desk came out of what?
A desk fell from above down on his onto him.
Did it come off of, out of a window?
No.
Did it come off of an elevated balcony?
No, I'm not sure.
You don't know.
That's correct.
Right? Okay. You don't even know what kind of desk it was.
That's correct.
Okay.
The defense also argued that Granville didn't have a serious criminal record before the murder charge, despite the fact he had been charged with sexual battery, aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, and domestic battery by strangulation, which is pretty serious in my opinion. They also argued that there was no evidence of a struggle, but once again I think the injuries to Felicia's genital area indicates otherwise. During the sentencing phase, Felicia's family were able to provide victim impact statements. Her mother, Demerson, spoke about her birth and how she liked to feed the ducks and sing in the church choir. She detailed how back in 2013, she had foot surgery and her daughter spent the summer cooking for her and nursing her back to health. Since Felicia's death, Demerson said that she'd been unable to return to work and takes medication for depression.
I can remember back in June of 2013 when I had my foot surgery. She stayed in the house the whole entire summer nursing me back to health. And not only did she do that, she also cooked for me, bathed me. And Sugar Plum also, at the time of my surgery, made sure my baby, who was 2 years old at the time, was well cared for. Even though Felicia was 9 years old, she was very smart, advanced, and very wise beyond her years. Like an elderly person would say, she was an old soul. You truly will never understand what a unique individual you took from us. Not only was she a daughter, she was a granddaughter to four sets of grandparents, a goddaughter, a niece, whom one of her aunts gave the honor of being nicknamed Sugar Plum. And she was an awesome aunt herself to her two nieces at the time of her demise. She was a sister to her six siblings who missed her tremendously and hurt every day. Felicia's death has affected my life and took its toll on my entire family. Even though it's been 5 years, it feels like 5 days ago. I have not yet returned to work. I've been diagnosed with chronic depression. I'm on 7 different types of medication trying to cope with this new normal called life. Some days, I don't know whether I'm coming or going.
The jury would ultimately decide that Granville Ritchie needed to die for what he had done to Felicia and recommended the death penalty. As they read their decision, laughter, tears, and clapping erupted in the courtroom. Outside of court, Demerson said, "As long as I know he's in that box for the rest of his life, that's all I care about because my daughter is up under all that dirt in a box for the rest of her life." The following year, it would be up to the judge to decide whether to agree with the jury's recommendation of sentencing Granville to death. Judge Michelle Sisko agreed, and she sentenced Granville to death. After the sentence was handed down, more victim impact statements were presented. Felicia's father, Jerome Williams, showed humility when he said that he had forgiven Granville.
"I'm not like everybody else, bro. I ain't got no ill will against you. That same Bible that you play with, bro, you get back to your cell, you get on your knees and you pray. Because the journey you got ahead of you, gonna need God. I forgive you. I ain't got no anger towards you, bro. Abraham was willing to sacrifice his child. I sacrificed mine. I was you. I once was you. And in these same courtrooms, I was a monster. I'm pretty sure they don't told you about me. I'm the one you don't want to see, bro. You took something from me you can't give back. I don't want no revenge. I gave it to my God. The same God that you play with, I gave it to him. And he took that person from me. Because I couldn't deal with myself. A lot of people would have suffered if I would have dealt with it. But the fact that it took 6 years, man, for you to be a man and admit to what you done wrong. All these people you hurt, man. Huh. Phone calls 2-3 o'clock in the morning, man. And I got to get up my bed and go console her. Go get her from the gravesite 4 in the morning. And she there crying about my baby. That's the woman you got to have for forgiveness. Let me tell you one thing about her, bro. It's hard for her to forgive. I've been dealing with for the last 17 years. And I'm still asking her for forgiveness. But I forgive you, bro. That's how strong my God is. I come in and smile at you today with no harm or ill wills towards you. You my brother. You made a mistake. But you got time. You got time to get right with God, bro. Like I said, I once was you. I was a monster. I was just like you. So if my God can change me to make me a better man, I do that. I celebrate the day.
He said that he didn't want revenge, because if he had have taken revenge, a lot of other people would have suffered, not just his own family.
And I'm pretty sure you know, my baby called after me. I wasn't there for my baby. But I'm gonna make sure I'm there for my others. Like I say, bro, don't play with God, bro. Ask him for forgiveness. You did wrong. Your mistake's just worse than others. When you get by to yourself, you get on your knees and you pray harder than you ever prayed in your life. And you ask for his forgiveness. Because I give you mine. I ain't got no ill will towards you, bro. I love you. You're a child of God. But don't play with him. Because if you play with him, he's going to destroy you. You take that Bible that them people give you, and you pray. And you ask him to make you a better man.
Demerson started her statement by thanking everybody who'd worked tirelessly on bringing justice for her daughter.
Also, I just want to say that I've waited 2,310 days for this day to come. I am here to stand as a wounded mother. I'm here wearing all black. Because I'm here to bury this Jamaican today. Because by the time he's long gone, my eyes may be closed. Anyway, ensuring certain hope of the resurrection to eternal life through our Lord Jesus Christ, we command to Almighty God, our brother, Granville Richie, and we command his body to the ground at its resting place. I want to thank everyone, like I say, for putting up with me, because he took away her innocence, her purity, her everything to get married, to bear children, just life itself. Some days, like I say, I don't know if I'm coming or going. I wake up, I think about her. I lay down, I think about her. I'm on so many different medications. And that don't even help. The only thing I regret today is that I cannot ask for his fate. And that would be for him to be hung. For him to feel what my daughter felt over and over and over again. It took him 3 times to strangle her. To get her actually gone. And, you know, I feel like death is the appropriate. My heart hasn't changed. And all I know, he needs to be like her.
Felicia's grandmother spoke about how much she missed her granddaughter.
I miss my baby. I miss her calling me. She's saying that I love you, Grandmama. She's always saying I love you, Grandma. And it's hard knowing what she has shown me, what had actually been done to her. But she do come to me all the time and showing me different things. But I'm not going to say as of right now. But it was wrong for what was done. And I just miss my grandbaby. It hurts. It hurts every day. You're going to bed nice. You're waking up nice. Making up during the day. You can't sleep just knowing what has been done to her. Why would they want to just do this to her? It wasn't right. It wasn't right. It just wasn't right.
After handing down the sentence, Judge Sisko said, "There will be no corporal redemption for you, your physical being, your person. You will remain incarcerated until the date of your death is scheduled to occur." The following month, Ebony would plead guilty to a charge that she lied during the investigation into the disappearance of Felicia. In exchange for her guilty plea, prosecutors agreed that they would seek a sentence for her of no less than 6 months in jail, with 5 years off probation. Felicia's family objected to the sentence, with her mother Demerson referring to it as a slap on the wrist. She would ultimately be sentenced to 75 days in jail, plus 5 years of probation. Before she was handed the sentence, Felicia's family were allowed to address Ebony. Felicia's grandmother, Brenda Johnson, asked Ebony why she didn't call 911, while Charlesia Adams, Felicia's sister, said, "How could you be so stupid to leave my sister with a man you didn't even know, that she didn't even know?" Ebony would apologise to the family, admitting that she had made mistakes which carried profound consequences. Through tears, she stated, "I'm sorry I made the wrong decision, a not thinking decision. I'm so embarrassed and heartbroken." During the hearing, prosecutors would acknowledge that they likely could not have secured a conviction without Ebony's testimony, but said that her lies early on in the investigation hampered it.
"I could remember the last conversation I had with Sugar Plum on May 16, 2014 at 4 p.m. And she never departed from her mommy without telling me that she loved me. Sugar Plum didn't only touch lives through death, she also touched lives through living. Sugar Plum had her first job at a local barbershop, sweeping the floor and taking the trash out. She never met a stranger. She came home at times after riding her bicycle bearing gifts from where she helped a neighbor or elderly person take out their trash, feeding their dogs, or just sitting on their porch and keeping them company."
When Granville Ritchie was found guilty of the murder of Felicia Williams, it had been a long time coming. It was the moment that her family and investigators who worked tirelessly had been waiting for 5 long years. On that fateful day, Felicia thought that she was safe in the hands of somebody that she thought of as a second mother, someone she referred to as her godmother. Tragically for Felicia, however, just days beforehand, Ebony Wiley had become smitten with an extremely sadistic man that she seemingly entrusted to care for Felicia alone, despite the fact she didn't actually know him, and seemingly didn't know that he had been harboring sadistic fantasies about underage girls. Well, besties, that's it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, a big massive thank you for listening. I'd also like to say a huge thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Lauren and Jenny. As you all know, Morbidology is a one-woman team. I research, write, host, and produce the episodes on my own, and the support on Patreon really goes such a long way. It helps me to defray the costs of filing Freedom of Information requests, which really make Morbidology episodes what they are. It also helps with archive subscriptions, hosting, and much more. If you join on Patreon, I send out a handwritten thank you card and also offer merch, including t-shirts, stickers, pins, badges, fridge magnets, and keys. Up on Patreon, I also have ad-free and early release episodes, as well as bonus monthly episodes of Morbidology Plus, behind the scenes, which include bonus audio, videos, and even case files obtained via Freedom of Information. If you'd like to join, just search for Morbidology or click the link in my show notes. I'd also like to thank everybody who's left a written review on Apple Podcasts. I always get bad reviews about my voice, so it's always a boost to read your kind comments. Morbidology is also up on social media, and I'd love for you to follow me there and share any thoughts on the cases I cover, or just have a chat. I really enjoy interacting with you all. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Reverie True Crime. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
I'm Paige, the host of Reverie True Crime. I tell stories of helpless victims, vicious killers,
Predators watching their prey before they strike. Survivors, petty crimes, people we think we know who do the unthinkable, and the dangers that lurk not only in the dead of night, but in plain sight and the light of day. Every once in a while, I'll also tell stories of the frightening paranormal, elusive cryptids, haunted locations, and conspiracies that may be silly or thought-provoking. You can listen to Reverie True Crime wherever you're listening to this podcast. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at Reverie Crime Pod, Facebook, Instagram, and even Tumblr at Reverie True Crime. Remember, stay safe, be aware of your surroundings at all times, and take care.